Next case for argument is Central States Teamsters versus Waste Management Company. Ms. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honor. This Court should consider the implications of its decision not just for the parties in this case and the modest contributions being sought by the pension fund, but also for the message that may be sent to the trustees of Central States and whether your decision will increase their already considerable power to a point that far exceeds the intent of the Taft-Hartley Act and ERISA. The fund essentially argues that because an employer has signed a collective bargaining agreement and participation agreement with language that has been drafted by the fund, which says that the employer consents to the trust agreement and to all the rules and regulations adopted by the trustees, whatever they might prove to be in the future, and because those rules give the trustees not only the power to write the rules, but then to decide what they mean.
Dad, you agreed to follow the trustees' rules. I don't understand this case. These agreements are perfectly clear. I don't know what you're doing here.
Well, we don't think that the agreements are at all
perfectly clear.
The argument about
prospectively is ridiculous, in my opinion. I mean, it's absurd, right? You've got the two clauses, the retroactive and the prospective clause. So if you try to terminate retroactively, that's barred. If you say, well, we're going to terminate, you know, starting a week from now, that's barred. And you say, if you say, well, we're going to terminate today, that's not barred. That doesn't make the slightest bit of sense.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, we think that what the trustees are saying doesn't make the slightest bit of sense either.
Don't change the subject. You explain what sense your argument about prospectively makes.
The sense that my argument makes is that given the reality of collective bargaining, the trustees' position makes it impossible for any employer to ever negotiate out. And I don't think that's what this Court ought to be telling the trustees they
so
can say.
So what you say is that they ought to have this little loophole where they say, no, we're not terminating tomorrow, we're not going back, we're terminating today. If we terminated effective tomorrow, we'd be barred. As long as we do it today, it's fine.
That seems to be what the
loophole, but it doesn't make any sense that anyone would include such a loophole.
The participation agreement, we think, itself is ambiguous, but when combined with the rehabilitation plan that was adopted after the participation agreement, then we become like the Kroger case, where you have two documents that appear unambiguous.
You look, Waste Management is a big company.
Yes.
And it's got, you know, I'm sure sophisticated lawyers like you.
We weren't advising
them
at the time.
They signed this. They didn't have to sign all these things, but they sign over and over and over again. And it's all perfectly clear, right? No possible ambiguity.
Paragraph 5 of the participation agreement says contributions continue after the term of the collective bargaining agreement until the employer is no longer obligated by the contract to contribute.
The reality is Waste Management wants to pull out at a time when its withdrawal liability will be minimized, right? That's the game here.
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Not exactly, but close enough.
Waste Management.
So you find a little tiny loophole so you can climb out and squiggle out and reduce your withdrawal liability.
Well, Waste Management had another unit withdraw during 2008. Because of a peculiarity in the statute, which the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation recognized and invited funds to fix, an invitation this fund has ignored, an employer that incurs successive partial withdrawals ends up paying much more than Congress intended. It was in order to get back to the congressional intent of the payment amount and payment streams that Waste Management tried to bunch some of its withdrawals into a limited number of years. So it's not exactly eliminating withdrawal liability itself. It's changing the payment pattern.
So when do these agreements expire? Well, they've expired.
The 2005 agreement would have expired on January 31st, 2009.
Right.
Waste Management and the union entered into early negotiations, which is a permissive subject of bargaining. And the parties...
I'm asking, so is this agreement still in force?
No.
There's a new agreement.
The agreement was terminated by agreement of the parties. The new agreement started on its ratification.
What does it provide?
It provides for no contributions to the fund. It provides for contributions to a 401k plan.
Right.
We are out.
Right, so you're out.
And the debate is over whether we are out for this unit.
It's no debate because you don't have any argument.
Well, with due respect, Your Honor, we think we do have an argument.
This language is so clear that your position is frivolous. There's no ambiguity. And since there's no ambiguity, there's no question about, you know, exercise of discretion or anything.
Well,
you're bound.
With all due respect, when the fund adopted a parts rehabilitation plan that defines a withdrawal as the ratification of a contract that no longer calls for contributions, and they did that after the participation agreement was signed, now you have two documents that contradict each other, and as in Kroger, that should go back to the trier of fact for resolution. Because what happened here was a ratification of agreement.
Now, what's the contradiction?
The rehabilitation plan that was adopted by the fund as part of the plan document in 2008, before this withdrawal, defines a rehabilitation plan withdrawal, which allows the trustees to cut benefits for the members.
But look, this is where we have the retroactively, prospectively stuff. Right?
This contract was ratified on the 14th.
That's in this participation agreement, right?
I don't believe that...
Is it in this participation agreement, or is it in somewhere else?
It's in this participation agreement, but we think the trustees
have a... Well, it's clear, right?
No, I don't think it is.
Why isn't it clear? Because prospectively doesn't encompass cancellation today, but only effective tomorrow? Is that it?
Prospectively is an agreement... For example, in Alphenberg Ford and in other cases cited by the fund, the parties agreed at the beginning that the employer would be able to stop contributing during an agreement when the older workers retired, a clear abuse of the fund's rules. And we don't dispute the fact that those are the prospective cessations that are prohibited by this language. There's nothing in the participation agreement that says that a contract can't end before its original stated term.
So you can't eliminate prospectively, but if you eliminate today, that has the same effect because it wipes out all the prospective liability as well.
It wipes out contributions for the remainder of the stated term, just as a plant closing would, just as a decertification would.
This is not a plant closing.
No, it isn't, but the impact
on
the fund is the same.
I don't understand you. What happens if they say, beginning a week from now, we're going to stop contributing? Now, isn't that banned by this?
Yes, it is.
But if they say, today we're going to stop contributing, you're saying that's not banned.
That's correct.
That doesn't make any sense.
I don't see why it doesn't, because...
Look, listen to what you're saying. So if I say I'm going to stop making any contributions to the plan at noon, that's forbidden. But if I say this minute I'm stopping, that's permissible. That's your argument.
But what you seem to be...
Is that your argument?
Yes, because otherwise an employer can never get out.
We're in a different universe.
Well, but... Under your interpretation, when can an employer ever get out of this pension fund? They can't get out at the end of a contract.
What's rotten out? You've said that. They're not making contributions anymore.
Yes.
Yeah, because it expired in January 2009. So what do you... That's how you get out. You don't have to make contributions perpetually, just until the end of the agreement. If you don't want an agreement that expires in 2009, pick a different date.
Well, that's exactly what the parties did on December 14th of 2008. They terminated that contract and entered into a new one. And we don't see anything in these documents, particularly in light of the real...
But I can't get over the argument you're making about the difference between... What time is it now? Between terminating at 10:35 and noon.
Yeah.
I don't get that. I mean, we hear a lot of crazy arguments, but this is among the craziest.
Well, Your Honor, we think that the rehabilitation plan withdrawal definition covers exactly what happened in our case. And that, under the Kroger case, renders the participation agreement ambiguous, even if you don't accept our argument that in itself it's ambiguous.
Counsel, with respect to the rehabilitation plan argument,
you
highlight that language in your briefing. However, you gave that argument short shrift at the district court level, relegating it to a couple of footnotes in the briefing. Is this argument developed enough to be considered preserved for appeal?
We believe it was preserved for appeal, Your Honor. It was brought to the district court's attention.
In a couple of footnotes, as Judge Pratt said?
It was there.
In footnotes.
Well, that's called ambushing, right? You can't preserve an issue. You have an important issue. You have to argue it to the district court. You don't bury it in footnotes.
We believe it was sufficiently preserved.
Right? That's forfeiture.
Well, I don't believe it's forfeiture, Your Honor.
It's not like a situation where you're arguing a case in the Court of Appeals, a dispositive precedent. You say, you know, we can't get anywhere here, but we want to reserve the argument because we want to go to the Supreme Court. You can do that. That's fine. But you have to make all your arguments in the district court and with enough substance so that the district judge, you know, feels that he or she is obligated to consider the argument because it's a serious argument. It's not something thrown in a footnote.
Well, when it comes to interpretation of documents, it is, you know, and you're talking in, you know, the fund was focusing on the participation agreement, and we pointed out in the footnote that this language in the rehabilitation plan that they themselves had adopted contradicted what was in the participation agreement. The fact that it's on the same page, but at the bottom of the page, we don't think is an insignificant bringing it to the court's attention. In terms of the argument that you can't go out prospectively, you can't go out retroactively, you know, in Jamail, the court said that justice demands a reasonable reciprocity in fund rules. The fund has so cabined the ability of the parties to negotiate out that there is no reciprocity in those fund rules.
I understand. Now, waste management is not some little person. It's a giant company. It can negotiate. It doesn't have to be bailed out by a court.
There really is no ability to negotiate any of the fund rules or documents because the alternative is withdrawal.
You said that they're no longer making any contributions to the plan. Well, they could have done that in 2005, right?
They could have in 2005.
They don't want to make contributions. They don't have to make contributions.
Thank you. I'll reserve render my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hoffa. Mr. Bogle? You dropped something. I don't know if it's important.
It's not. Thank you. Warning, counsel.
Warning.
May it please the court, my name is Edward Bogle, and I represent the appellee in this matter and the plaintiff below, Central States Pension Fund. Judge, as has been well identified in the appellant's argument, at the heart of this case are four documents which we believe unambiguously prohibit the conduct that Waste Management undertook, which is to say bargaining out of the fund prior to the expiration of its 2005-2009 CBA. The collective bargaining agreement, the participation agreement, the fund's trust agreement, and the fund's plan document each individually prohibit this conduct, and read together, there can be no other explanation than this conduct is in fact prohibited, and contractually Waste Management was not permitted to do what they did. Now, to address a point that counsel raised with respect to this language, it is not impossible for a company to ever get out of the fund. In fact, it happens all the time. The critical element, though, is that a company, short of a bankruptcy or some other collapse that prevents the company from continuing operations mid-contract, as long as it's a going concern, the fund expects that company to participate and to contribute through the stated end date of its collective bargaining agreement. Had Waste Management wished to end its obligation under the terms of the participation agreement and the plan documents in this case, it could have done so. That new contract, though, should have had a beginning date of February 1st, 2009, the day after the 05-09 CBA ended on its terms. Now, the very purpose of this language, the reason why it was written into the trust agreement and why it appears in the participation agreement and plan document, is to exactly prevent this kind of strategic behavior. The fund has to be able to rely on the collective bargaining agreements that it receives. Amongst the materials that were in the administrative record that went to the trustees in this matter and that are presented at this court is a copy of the minutes, which can be found on page 54 of the fund supplemental appendix, which show exactly the reason why this language was included in the trust agreement, to prevent this kind of strategic behavior. And that was done back in 2005, before any of this issue with waste management had arisen. It's an independent issue apart from this employer, and it applies to all of the employers in the fund. In addition, to the issue of this question of rehabilitation plan withdrawals, you know, the question of whether or not it's preserved, I leave for the court. I will point out that it was also not raised to the Board of Trustees when the administrative appeals process was going on. That said, just to clarify, because I think there may be some confusion, at least on the part of waste management, about what this means. A rehabilitation plan withdrawal under the plan occurs on the date a contributing employer is no longer required to make contributions under one or more of its collective bargaining agreements as a result of ratification or other acceptance of a collective bargaining agreement which permits withdrawal. That language can be found on page 92 of our supplemental appendix. So under the unambiguous terms of the plan and the trust agreement and the participation agreement, that withdrawal date, that lawful cessation of an obligation to contribute, occurred on January 31st, 2009. It's one date. This doesn't shift the dates around.
What is a rehabilitation plan?
A rehabilitation plan is a plan such as Central States, which from an actuarial standpoint is in critical funding status. In other words, it is a plan whose liabilities exceed its abilities to pay actuarially at any given time. So in this case, as a result of the changes made by the Pension Protection Act, the Central States Fund is in rehabilitation plan status. It has adopted a rehabilitation plan, which is designed to put it on a sounder financial footing.
So it's the Central States plan that is financially shaky.
That's correct, Your Honor. And you know, all of this, I would argue, is besides the point since we have these unambiguous documents. But since the issue is raised, I just want to clarify that the withdrawal date under a rehabilitation plan withdrawal or the withdrawal date, had this occurred at some other point in time, is the same, because the trust agreement provides that you have to stay in and make that contribution obligation.
Does a rehabilitation plan impose additional liabilities on the employers?
Your Honor, I am not positive. I can say that just to give you an example, one of the things that a rehabilitation plan withdrawal does is it provides the ability for a plan to provide reduced benefits to certain groups of pensioners. I confess that I'm not fully well enough equipped to speak to it in detail, but it does provide a separate mechanism, which again is focused through the Pension Protection Act of 2006 on helping plans like Central States, which are underfunded, to get back on their feet financially.
Well, what's the impact of a rehabilitation plan? A rehabilitation plan withdrawal would be what, an employer wanting to get out of the rehabilitation plan?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that a rehabilitation plan withdrawal would occur when an employer withdraws from a plan in critical status.
It would have to make some it would have withdrawal liability.
An employer that withdraws from Central States is generally going to incur withdrawal liability under any circumstances.
Bigger under if there were a rehabilitation plan?
It could be. Just to draw back to this case to give you an example, it's not right now, today, it's unclear exactly what the difference between a 2008 withdrawal for Waste Management of Michigan would be versus a 2009 withdrawal for Waste Management of Michigan. And the reason for that is because this would be a partial withdrawal, since Waste Management as a going national concern has a number of other entities which participate in the fund. So as a partial withdrawal, it's difficult today to say exactly what that amount would be because we don't know what the final complete withdrawal date would be. Likewise, we don't have all the unfunded vested benefit figures available to us right now. So just to kind of draw it back to some of the issues that we face with, in this case, with these plan documents, part of the reason why the trustees set up this mechanism where we hold employers to the dates that appear in their contracts is so that this kind of strategic behavior is prevented. And generally, it may or may not work in favor of the funds. It may be that an employer is held to its contract through 2008, and that is a higher withdrawal liability than if it was held to its contract in 2009. So as the actuarial status of the plan changes, it's not always going to be that if the fund keeps you in longer, you are going to incur more withdrawal liability. So this is about just providing certainty to be able to understand where those collective bargaining relationships begin and end. Your Honor, if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I'll rest on the brief at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Bogle. Ms. Hoffman, how much time does she have? 2 minutes.
I just wish to address a few points that Mr. Bogle raised. One is that we had sought evidence on inconsistent treatment of other employers under this language. Mr. Bogle said that the early withdrawal date could cut both ways. If, in fact, the evidence showed that when it favored the fund, they allowed employers to negotiate out early, when it doesn't favor the fund, they don't, that evidence of inconsistent treatment makes even a reasonable decision unreasonable and requires a remand to the trier of fact, as this Court has said in the Barker case. Mr. Bogle also talked about how the fund needs to rely on the receipt of contributions for the full initial term of the collective bargaining agreement. But in their most recent annual report, the fund shows $20 billion of assets with a 7.5% assumed investment return and $600 million of contributions. That means that missing their investment target by one percentage point, earning 6.5% instead of 7.5%, would cost the fund $200 million, the same as losing a third of their employers. So I doubt very much that their actuaries are counting on every employer contributing for the last 6 weeks of their collective bargaining agreement in setting their calculations. I think they're far more focused on their investment return based on the numbers.
Is it your proposition that even when the language of a plan is clear that a participant is entitled to discovery to see whether the plan administrators were operating under conflict of interest?
We think selective enforcement is a question of bad faith. And the court...
I don't understand that. If the language is clear, why should a court look behind that?
Well, we don't agree that the language...
I know you don't agree. You're wrong, but you don't agree. That's fine. But supposing the language were clear,
yes,
we can't have a situation where every time there's a dispute over an ERISA plan, you get discovery of the plan administrator. Contract case is supposed to be decided when there's a clear written contract on the contract. You don't get into discovery.
The only question is whether there's
a contract law. If every time there was a breach of contract suit, the defendant said, oh, it's clear on its face, but I don't know, we think maybe this company was acting in bad faith.
No, I agree with that proposition that you're presenting, Your Honor. There is a doctrine of latent ambiguity, and we just don't know if that's in place here, given the fact that there have been publicly known circumstances where employers have been let out early.
Well, counsel, you essentially had three discovery requests.
Yes.
That were denied. Historical behavior of how trustees have ruled when
yes.
other employers cease paying obligations to the fund, the fund's adherence to policies and procedures, and the deposition of trustee Fred
Gegear.
Yes. Now, explain how any of this discovery could show a latent ambiguity in an otherwise unambiguous contract. Specifically, can you identify any potential latent ambiguity?
The only one that would address potential latent ambiguity is the question of inconsistent treatment of other employers in terms of how they interpreted this language in other similar circumstances.
But you know what's really bad about that argument is when you have a company that has a lot of contracts, suppose they're terribly clear, right? But on the other hand, the company will often say, yeah, you know, we have a clear contractual right, but you're a very good customer, so we're not going to enforce against you, right? That doesn't mean that they can't enforce the rest of their contracts, right?
But
it certainly doesn't mean that means that every time they sue someone else, that someone else can get discovery to show they forgave someone who had the same contract, and therefore they have a conflict of interest? I mean, that way madness lies.
Well, the question
right?
is if they have a pattern and practice of doing that.
Pattern and practice. What does that mean?
It means perhaps they do it only...
I mean, look, suppose you're...
Only for buddies Macy's. Of the trustees?
Suppose you're Macy's or something like that. And you sell something, and sometimes a person comes back and says, oh, I didn't really want to buy it, made a terrible mistake. And the salesman says, all right, you know, you can return it. We don't, you know, it's not our policy, but we'll... That's any large company is constantly, you know, waiving contractual rights. So you're opening a tremendous can of worms if you say that in any contract case, no matter how clear the contract...
No, I don't think we've said
that. And can always say, oh, you know, other people, it's a pattern in practice... They forgive other people. They're unfair to us. No, you can't go down that road.
All right, I'm not going down that road, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Hoffman and Ms. Bogle. And